Mr. Holdsworth, reel 3. So you're saying that they ended up in the water?
Yes, and just as he said there. Oh no, that was what it was. We weren't being dropped, we were being hoisted. And we come to the falls, and we hooked on, and then they were going to say hoist away. Well, as soon as he said hoist away, they started to pull. All the ship's company were lined up with the falls along the side of the ship. As soon as he said hoist away, the skipper said, you know, slow ahead. So this side was my fall, all went flying down nearly over the end of the over the stern of the ship. And he said, you know, slow ahead. And we started moving. Oh, we were, you know, dangling on these bloody falls in the water there, and the boat there flopping about. So he had to come to a halt again. And we had to make fast again, and they had to bail the bloody boat out as well. And he shouted down the captain from the bridge, send that boy to my cabin. It was quite funny.
So what happened to you then?
I just got stoppage of leave. But I mean, that was not much account. It was just one of those things.
So, one thing that... asking about the attitude of the men on the ship to you. Would they sort of look out for you? You know, would you be friends with them, or would you just pair off with your own?
No, you were separate from them. They were you'd separate boys' mess decks. So they were in their own mess decks, seaman's mess deck, Sparks, stokers presumably, because they were kept secret, kept separate in the trade sort of thing. So, I mean, we had our own mess deck, the boys in.
Have you ever heard the expression winger used in the sense of an older sailor taking advantage of a younger boy, home section?
Well, I mean, that could be one interpretation of it, but, I mean, the interpretation that we had in the Navy was your winger was your mate. The guy next to you on the wing, sort of. You know, certainly they were. I mean, when you're at sea a long time and so on, and you're away from women, there's quite a bit of homosexuality. I mean, in the Navy, there's a different attitude to homosexuality. It's quite accepted. I mean, they accept homosexuality. It's just, you know, one of those things. That doesn't mean to say they participate in it. There's a lot of talk of participating in it, but... actually, very, very few do. There are, I mean, you do get homosexuals on the ships. But, I mean, it's like the sailor coming back to the ship, you know, all the girls he's slept with. I mean, everybody knows he's not slept with anybody, you know. They all know that all the boy seamen are virgins, and a lot of the ordinary seamen are virgins. And the able seamen aren't virgins because they're engaged or something like that. I mean, that was the reality. You all knew it was bullshit. And a lot of homosexual talk is bullshit as well, because that becomes, you know, that's a sexual thing sort of thing. Because there's no women, so, I mean, the sexual thing is men. But it's as much reality as, you know, that with the women.
Did it surprise you to hear people talking about this?
Well... I don't know, I don't think so.
Because normally it's not something that is talked about a lot, or certainly not something people would talk about engaging in, whether they had or not, openly. You're saying there's a different attitude in the Navy?
In the Navy, yes.
Can you
say
a bit about what you mean by that?
Well, it's portrayed. It's like, that was what I was trying to say. When you come back off a shore leave and so on, they talk, they're all talking about, oh, this girl, you know, I had and all this. Whereas they didn't get anywhere, you know, they probably went to the pictures or something, or had a drink together or something, that was as far as it went. They talk about this. So there's a lot of talk about homosexual relations, but it's on the same level. You know, It's like a dream.
When you say a lot of talk about it, do you mean a lot of gossip about other people? Or would people themselves talk about it?
Say, people themselves
say,
talk
oh,
about
I,
it.
You know, I've had a relationship.
Oh, I give him a right going over sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, it is an offence in the Navy, isn't it?
Oh, yes, but yeah.
There weren't, to your knowledge, any cases of people being disciplined for it?
No, no, although they knew, and some of the officers had homosexual relationships with their steward. You know, I mean, it was known. But
that's a bit of a joke, isn't it, that whole
Yeah. Because they're in a real oppressed position, the steward. You know, and the officer would force relationships on them. And they all reckon the midshipmen, you know, were homosexually abused sort of thing. Were made to undergo a homosexual relationship with some of the officers and that. That was generally. But, I mean, it was a lot of fantasy talk. I tend to believe, you know. I don't think all that much went on. There's a lot of thinking about it. Because there's a lot of wet dreams in the Navy. You know. And I think some of them confused, you know, reality with the dream world sort of thing. Because if you're cut off from women, then any relationship, sexual thing you have, is with men, isn't it? I mean, it's a natural thing, isn't it? Bound to be.
So, you think if it went on at all, it was a lot of it was to do with just sexual frustration?
Yes, yes, definitely.
And given that it was something that was talked about openly, do you think that most of the actual occurrences of homosexuality would be people abusing their position of authority? When you talk about the captain and steward, would it be a situation where, you know, a boy seaman would be taken advantage of? Or were you frightened of that happening?
No. I mean, if somebody tried to force it on in the mess, you know, you're involved in the mess, I mean, you'd do him over sort of thing.
Did that happen at all?
No.
But you talked about the possibility of that happening, did you?
No. But there were homosexual relationships with their older people and young boys. I mean, I saw it on the Jamaica and on the Implacable. But the young boy certainly wasn't impressed. I mean, he used his homosexuality to get privileged positions, you know, and would have three or four lovers at the same time, you know, and playing them off. And it was quite funny to watch. I mean, we used to have a real good laugh because generally the ones that'd be playing off would be the older hands with a bit of power, you know, and they'd be really playing them off against each other and saying things like, stop being so jealous. we used to have a good laugh, you know. I mean, certainly they weren't, homosexuals weren't ostracised or anything. You know.
But you think that people would be quite pragmatic about these things, really?
Yeah.
Do you think the people who really did have homosexual relationships were doing it because they were homosexual
or partly just to
get on?
We had it, no. Some of them were because they were homosexual. I mean, Woodcock on the Jamaica was like that. I mean, he was having relationships with the load. Generally, when they were having a drink, you know, they'd have some sort of relationship with him. He was with loads of them. But I was on the Jamaica.
And with examples like this, you say that, you know, you saw things going on, but would a lot of that just be talk anyway as well?
There was some of it, you know, was there? Was like proper relationships, you know, lovers sort of thing, you know.
And would it be common, say, for people to, you know, stick together for a long period? As if it was just I don't know.
I didn't know of any that stuck together for a long period. I mean, the relationships were a lot kept secret, you know. Because there was all sorts of jealousies.
When you were, so we're still sort of talking about the period when you'd first got on ship. Were there still any HOs on board these ships?
Yes, quite a few. Quite a few. In fact, when I was on the Implacable 48, there were still quite a few HOs that hadn't been demobbed yet.
You said that when you...
Not 48, what am I talking about? 46. 46, 47, yeah.
You said that when you were at the second training camp, the Ganju, that they were tightening up the regime.
Yeah, yeah.
Partly as a result of the sort of concessions that had been made to HOs.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what we thought, you know, because when you discussed it, there was always some theorist that had an explanation like that.
Because, as you'll be well aware, at the outbreak of the Second World War, there was a lot of talk, particularly from the people from the Communist Party and so on, who joined the forces, of there was a sort of demand, I believe, to democratise the army.
Mm.
It was a bit of a slogan. And the idea that, you know, that in the First War, the problem was that the old officers didn't know what they were doing, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So do you think during the war, in the Navy as well, there had been a certain amount of a token nod towards democratising things a bit because of the HOs who had brought in?
No, there was no democracy. There was a loosening of discipline. That's what I'd call it. I mean, there was also... there was a lot of... one of the stories that went around, you know, was how unpopular officers had been got rid of over the side. Put in a wash deck locker, knocked out, put in a wash deck locker, and the wash deck locker thrown over the side. How they threw a wash deck locker over the side, I don't know, because they're quite bloody big heavy things, big steel lockers that you put your brooms in and so on. But there was a lot of talk of unpopular petty officers and that being thrown over the side at sea, you know, when the ship was blacked out. And if they went over, that was it. So there was that. I mean, they weren't... They'd not the stake a regular had in, that he knew he was going to be in there forever. They were only there for the duration of the war. You know, so they weren't going to put up with all the bullshit that the regular, had accepted that they'd have to put up with.
Were they treated differently by the professional scene, the HOs?
Yeah, they were looked down on, you know.
They were?
The professional seamen thought they were just civilians in uniform, sort of thing.
And did they, the HOs, see themselves that way, as civilians first?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we were more skilled than them, as I was saying about splicing and all that. As boy seamen, we were like the cream of the skilled people on the ship, the ex-boy seamen. We had all the skills that they were still learning, you know, as able seamen.
Were the HOs not selected for the Navy on the grounds of some sort of relevant experience, you know, engineering or whatever? Or were they just...
Some of them presumably were, some of them, you know, the engineering artificers and that. But the bulk of them were seamen.
Merchant seamen?
No, no, were seamen, you know, they weren't ones that did the guns and, you know, the torpedoes and what have you.
Was it not... I would imagine it would be a lot harder to bring in people like that to the Navy than to the Army.
It was harder to get into the Navy. Yes, it was. They were more selective than the Army. And the Air Force, even.
But what I'm getting at is I would have thought the effect on a ship of having people who weren't fully trained would be a lot more problematic than, say, bringing a lot of people into an army unit. But, you know, simply because of the things we were talking about before, that the fact that you have to organise your own life so tightly.
Well, of course, they'd have training in barracks. I mean, they went to, when they joined, they went to the home barracks, like the three barracks, Devonport, Portsmouth and Chatham. And they had training schools there that they went to when they started. Like, Devonport was HMS Drake. Victory was Portsmouth. And they went there and they had a basic training. They weren't totally without skills. They had a basic training. I don't know how long. But, I mean, we'd had training for a few years. We were like apprentices, us. So they were like in the factories, I presume. Like they were like the semi-skilled, and we were like the skilled. Yeah.
This period we're talking about, before you became 18, and you're still a boy seaman, I've heard that discipline for boy seamen, certainly in the period just before the outbreak of war, was very strict indeed, and that, in fact, flogging was still quite common.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about discipline as a boy seaman?
Yes, you had the stick, you know, they had the...
This would be at the training barracks.
Yeah, there was like... it was like a bundle of sticks that you were whipped with, you know. I think there was a couple that had had it. It wasn't all that often.
What kind of thing would you have to do to warrant that?
Stealing, I think. Criminal offences, you know. Or insubordination or something like that. But there was flogging. They did flog some. In fact, during the war and after the war, I think.
Was it any worse than the sort of summary justice you would have got off the other people, the other boy seamen?
No.
So it was more just as an example?
Yeah. I mean, it was severe. You know, you were like semi-hospitalised after it. But you'd sooner get that. I mean, it was over and done with than being beat up and then ostracised by your mates. I know which I'd have preferred.
What would be the attitude to people who'd been insubordinate, say, and been flogged for it?
Well, it was like, what would be the attitude to a child at school that had been insubordinate to the teacher and been flogged for it? I mean, you'd so you have a bit of respect for him, don't you? I mean, you do, don't you? I mean, somebody takes on the teacher, but gets flogged. I mean, you admire him, okay, you know, he's got flogged for it, but he took the teacher on. So's and them, after all.
So, you're saying, you talk about us and them. I was going to ask you about this, because I've heard life on ship described as, you know, one big family. I mean, literally, you're all in the same boat. You're all pulling together and all this. Yet, from what you say, it seems that being in close proximity with officers on board a ship could have the opposite effect, really, of actually making that antagonism even stronger when you're living with these people all the time. What do you think about it? How does this sort of thing evolve on a ship?
Well, I mean, they obviously felt that way as well, because the general layout, certainly where you were a capital ship, you had marines on the ships, and they were billeted between the ship's company and the officers. And they did that. You know, it wasn't accidental that they did that, because they looked to the marines to defend them from the ship's company. So they had no doubts, no illusions about it being a big happy family. They knew we hated them, and literally did hate them. They were like a race apart, the officers. They all had these upper class accents. The working class can always differentiate between the landed gentry that they felt was quite reasonable because of its paternalism, you know, and the responsibility. I mean, you can see it with, like, Macmillan, Aaron Macmillan, how that the gentry felt, and, Willie Whitelaw, how the gentry feels responsibility for the workers. You know, they think they're having it hard. I've had it fairly soft. These are really had it hard. And so they feel responsible for them. And they're quite reasonable. You can talk to them. Whereas the young officer class from the middle class, you know, these sort of accountants and lawyers and what have you, when they go into something like this, they're more upper class than the upper class. Their accents are sort of even stronger because they're trying to fit in, you know, keep up. And they're so bloody supercilious about everything. They see themselves as superior in every way to you. Even these snotties, you know, the midshipmen, who know absolutely nothing that you're really carrying around, see themselves as a class apart above you, you know. You feel like the blacks must feel in South Africa, you know, with the whites. Even the sort of the lumpheads feel, you know, adopt a superior attitude to you. So, I mean, you certainly don't feel one family in the same family. I mean, you don't even seem on the same bloody planet with them. And I know the Navy, they used to call them pigs bastards, the officers, because they didn't feel pigs were strong enough, you see. So they were pigs bastards. And they really hated them. And there's no doubt about it. The stewards used to spit into the meals before they served them and things like that.
You saw that happen, did you?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, they really hated them. And they were so obnoxious. We had a tot of rum at dinner time, right? And that was our drink. And the reason for that was to sort of pacify us. Because by dinner time, you'd really had a bellyful of it all. So you had your tot at 12 o'clock, you went for a quarter to. You drank the tot, which was a glass of grog. But it was very strong rum. It's not like ordinary rum mixed with water. It was quite strong. It was 2 and 1, 2 parts of water to 1 of rum. Except on destroyers where you got 1 and 1. And you'd drink this and it'd dope you during the dinner time. You had a bit of a sleep after your dinner. Till, you know, it was cold. And then that lasted you, you know. And but they had drinks in the wardroom, you know, all the bloody time. And we'd be having these parties where they'd be wrecking the wardroom and so on. And, I mean, remember them putting the cat in the piano. It wasn't their bloody cat, it was the ship's cat, you know. And stuff like that, they were, you know, cruel buggers. And the crew generally hated them. On the, where you have a make amend on a Saturday or Sunday and say you weren't on watch, but you couldn't go ashore because you were at sea, you'd have what they call a make amend. Where, you know, you're supposed to mend whatever needed, doing or make the uniforms, because they used to make the home uniforms at one time. And they'd be daydreaming, certainly our mess on was, daydreaming about mutinying and taking over the ship and killing all the officers off. You know, they'd be like devising various deaths for the various officers and so on. No, it was never seen as a, you know, a big happy family, you know.
How would you know about, you know, for example, the parties that you mentioned?
Well, the stewards would tell you. Oh, aye, they were very vocal.
And the officers weren't bothered that the stewards were seeing this going on, though?
No, no, no. They were like servants anyway, you know, no bugger noticed them. No.
You talk about when you're comparing a ship, like a bit of a microcosm, you know, of the world outside.
Mm.
So where does the aristocracy fit in with all this? Where, how would they be reproduced in the Navy?
Well, of course, the old Navy used to be the sons, younger sons of the aristocracy, didn't they? They went into the Navy, the services, or the church, or the colonies. Because all their land was, so they wouldn't be split up the land, it would go to the eldest son, you know. So the youngest sons got nout. So they'd be parcelled off into these things. But of course, you know, with the sort of the capitalists developing, you had, I mean, they were providing quite a lot of the officers as well, you know. They'd buy a commission and so on, and put the son into Dartmouth and so on.
But you were talking about the nastiness of the officers on your ship.
Yeah.
But would you find, say, if you went up to the top ranks, a different attitude at all?
Yeah, seemed to do. I know when I mean, the third Sea Lord, I'd mentioned at Ganges, so it didn't seem any different. But I have met admirals that seem to be from the, you know, the aristocracy. Had this reasonable air about them. Yeah, you could tell the difference. You know, the...
But do you think that was just because of their position, or do you think that was actually something to do with their background? Do you think when you get to the very top, you have to take a more dispassionate view of things?
Yeah, I mean, there were some reasonable officers, you know. But in the bulk, they were hateful bastards. And you didn't meet so many admirals anyway. It's not as though you were bumping into admirals on a regular basis.
Although, when we talk a bit later about your time in prison, perhaps we'll talk about when you did make one. So, you're talking about life on ship, and it sounds like there was a lot of antagonism, to say the least. At this time, were you at all politically conscious?
No.
When did you start becoming aware of politics at all?
Oh, it was after we'd come back from... Well, while we were in the Korean War and the Malayan War, you began to wonder what these people were fighting for. I mean, we'd had a brush with the North Koreans. I was on Jamaica then, and we were the first British ship. We were in Japan and Kure when the...
Perhaps if we go through it in order. You were in Malaya first, were you, before Korea?
No.
When did you go to Korea then?
We sort of went out to relieve the Amethyst, to relieve the London, which had been caught up in the Amethyst thing up the Yangtze. We were on the American and West Indies station, Jamaica, and Belfast, the one that's in London at the moment, you know, on the Thames, with the two ships out there. And the cruiser London, an 18-inch cruiser, had gone up the Yangtze, supposedly to rescue the consulate staff, you know, and had got shot up badly by the 8th Route Army, along with the Amethyst. The Amethyst had run aground. The London came back, and we were sent over to relieve her. And Christ, when we saw her, she hadn't really been shot up. And so we were sent from the best station, American and West Indies, to the worst, the Far Eastern station. We sailed across the Pacific in 6 weeks.
What do you mean, the best and the worst?
Well, the Americas was seen as the best station.
Why?
Well, the hospitality, the weather, whereas the Far East was hot and damp. You know, prickly heat, sweat rash, sort of miserable bloody weather. Whereas South America was like perfect weather. It was hot and dry. And the Caribbean wasn't so bad either. You know, Bermuda, the Caribbean. We were based at Bermuda. And we'd just done a Caribbean tour and a South American tour down to Chile and Peru, Colombia, Antigua and so on, when we were in Bermuda, when we were told we had to provision ship and clear off across the Pacific to relieve the London. So we went via Hawaii, and it took us 6 weeks to get across there. Well, when we got across there, we went up the Yangtze to meet the Amethyst, who did a rush for freedom sort of bullshit propaganda thing. And then we went on a tour of Japan. And we.
So when you say it was a bullshit propaganda thing, what do you mean by that?
Well, when the Amethyst went aground, the captain gave the order to abandon ship. I think the captain was killed. Some of them were too frightened to jump over the side, right, and swim to shore. And they stayed on the ship, the ones that were frightened, with Lieutenant Cairns, who was the first lieutenant.